next case of the day, which is Great Plains Livestock versus Midwest Insurance. Justice Miller Lerman, excuse me, Justice Stacy is recused in this matter, and the court will be joined by District Court Judge Kozisek from the 8th Judicial District from Haynesworth.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Judge Kozisek.
Good morning.
Counsel, is it Mr. Weeks?
Yes, sir.
Good morning to you. And we have Mr. Blagg. Good morning to you. And Mr. Minahan, good morning to you. Do I understand correctly you're going to split your time?
Yes, with court's permission.
You may, 5 minutes apiece. You have to keep track of that. Time. The bailiff does not keep track of that.
You know, they're doing their arguments in lockstep.
Very good. We appreciate that. Do any counsel have any questions before we begin?
May I have presents for rebuttal, Your Honor?
You may. Mr. Weeks, yeah, then you may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Weeks with Baylor Evnen, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants, Great Plains Livestock Consulting and Kai Fanning. This case involves allegations that two insurance agencies and an agent were negligent in failing to secure an errors and omissions policy for the appellants. While there was no E&O policy in effect, the appellants were sued in two Iowa cases. The issue before this court is whether a case is ripe for adjudication when defense costs in the two Iowa lawsuits had accrued and are ongoing, but there has not yet been a final settlement or judgment in the two Iowa cases.
Your complaint seems to raise issues of duty to indemnify and duty to defend. Is that correct?
Correct.
The district court made some reference to there's no liability until the Iowa case is resolved, and there's no damages, or damages are uncertain at this point. When the judge is talking about liability, what was he referring to? Was he referring to the duty to indemnify?
My understanding is that he's focused solely on the duty to indemnify and ignored the duty to defend.
What have we said about duty to indemnify and when that becomes ripe or accrues?
In terms of an insurance contract? I think an insurance contract, it would be upon, you know, the payment of a settlement or a judgment.
So how does that affect this negligence action?
Well, I think there's two things there, Your Honor. First of all, in terms of a ripeness analysis, there is ongoing damages associated with the duty to defend.
Okay, well, I'm still just on the duty to indemnify.
Yeah, and on the duty to indemnify, I would direct the court to City of Omaha versus City of Elkhorn, 276 Nebraska 70. And in that case, the ripeness, there was a little bit more detailed ripeness analysis that was performed. And the issue there was whether or not it was ripe for the court to interpret certain severance provisions and contracts that the City of Elkhorn had when the City of Elkhorn had an active appeal or a pending appeal on whether or not Omaha could annex it. And this court decided that even though that there was an appeal pending, that that case was ripe. So I think that there's a similar thing here where, although there's a contingency, certainly, there was also a contingency in that case as to whether or not the court would even need to consider the contractual provisions, or whether or not the pending appeal made that a contingent, not ripe matter. So the other thing I would add to that is there is, I think, a certainty to this case that there is not in the City of Omaha case, in that there will be a settlement or judgment in the two Iowa lawsuits. So, I understand there's a separate issue of a stay that I'm trying not to get into right now, but I think at the point that the case was filed, even though there was no settlement or judgment yet in the Iowa cases, all the elements of a negligence claim could be met at day one.
May I interrupt you? Was there a ruling on a stay of the proceedings?
There was not, Your Honor.
What elements of damages you maintain exist at the time of the filing?
At the time of the filing, we introduced evidence that from the Iowa attorney as to his cost to defend those two suits to date.
But the expenses are continuing to be incurred.
Correct.
This is a negligence suit. You're not asking for any kind of declaration that these companies ought to actually be doing the defense work.
I filed two actions, Your Honor, at the same time. I filed a deck action, and I included the underwriters in that lawsuit as well as the two agencies to provide them an opportunity, because I don't know all the facts. I didn't know whether they were going to say, hey, we told you Lloyd's of London to get this policy in place and you didn't do it. So
that deck action is not part of this appeal.
That's correct. Yeah. But I did file that contemporaneously with this. And I got a dismissal in that case as well. And so I think that that was also important to the ripeness issue here, because I wanted an exhaustion of coverage, because obviously if there's a contractual obligation to provide, then there would be no negligence action to be brought against the insurance agencies. Going back to the City of Omaha case, one of the things that the court talked about in its ripeness jurisprudence is kind of a two-pronged analysis that it adopted, and it considered two things: whether or not the court can act as a judicial matter, and secondly, whether or not the court also should act as a prudential matter. Here, I think the court can certainly act.
What significant harm do you see or maintain would occur based upon the actions of the trial court?
My concern, Your Honor, is a statute of limitations issue.
Okay. And what you maintain the statute of limitations accrues at what point in time?
Well, I think it can be at the time of the error, the failure of the agency to secure the coverage. It could also accrue, arguably, at the time that my clients were actually brought into a lawsuit in Iowa. They were third-party in. And so at that point was when there was an active claim against my clients. And so at an abundance of caution, I want to make sure that I got the lawsuits on file, because what I didn't want to happen was we wait years for the Iowa lawsuits to resolve, and then by the time I bring a lawsuit, I'm met with an affirmative defense of the statute of limitations that accrued some point back in time.
I understand why you did what you did out of abundance of caution, but aren't you protected from a possible statute of limitations defense down the road by a finding that you didn't have ripe claims? I mean, if it's not ripe, it doesn't accrue and the clock doesn't start running. Isn't that right?
I would sure hope so. I mean, I think if this court rules that, if this court finds that this action is not ripe, then I don't think my clients have anything to worry about. I was concerned because of the incurring of defense costs that it was ripe, and that later on I could be met with that defense by opposing counsel. There's nothing at this time. I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Black, good morning to you.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I am Dave Black, representing Midwest Insurance. As we've noted previously, Mr. Minahan represents the other appellees, and we're going to try and split up time, and me taking no more than 5 minutes. Good morning, Mr. Weeks. As Chief Justice pointed out, this is not a declaratory judgment action. This is a case at law for damages in which you're entitled to a jury. And what brings to me the question of ripeness is, if this case is ripe and was sitting in the district court, we should be able to get a call from the judge saying, I've got a break in my schedule, let's try this thing Tuesday. And the posture of this case right now, you can't do it, because you're asking a jury for an advisory opinion to enter a judgment for things that have not occurred. And as you pointed out, in the area of insurance, this court is very strictly divided the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify. And in terms of the duty to indemnify, we don't have a judgment for which to indemnify, let alone an amount. We're guessing.
What about the duty to defend?
Well, the duty to defend is ongoing, and since it's an indemnity action, it doesn't arise until all of the amounts are paid. While...
Where does the duty to defend arise from? From the contract, right?
From the insurance contract. But I think one thing that gets confused here is when you're talking about a failure to procure insurance, is you're saying the agent has a duty and breach of that duty has to pay what the insurance company paid. It doesn't say you become the insurance company. It's a case for damages after that you have to pay what the insurance company pays. There's no cases that say, okay, now you become the insurance company and you have to assume the duty to defend.
Was there some discussion in, or does this record show anything about engaging in an agreement to defend and sign a reservation of rights?
I don't recall anything in the record. And I came this in appellate stage, but I don't recall anything. There may be, but I have no recollection of that happening.
Thank you.
So it's clear that the appellant has incurred some defense cost in Iowa.
The record reflects that that has occurred, yes. So we would not contest that.
So there are some damages, potentially, if there is a fact, a duty, and a breach, and there potentially some damage. $4,000 at the time of the briefing. It's probably more by now.
Right.
So does that make it ripe or not ripe?
I think the problem is because you have an indemnity action, you're giving a judgment for what has been spent. And that's why I go back to what's the trial court going to do? Give an instruction to the jury that says, in terms of defense costs, we found they're liable, and the amount of the verdict is to be determined. Juries can't do that.
Appellant seems to argue in his reply brief that this is similar to a personal injury case with ongoing medical expenses, and those cases get filed and proceed towards trial. Why can't this case?
Here there are a couple of points. One is that because of the division between the duty to defend and duty to indemnify, that part, the duty to indemnify, is really a separate issue, or really a separate claim that's not right. And in terms of personal injury, what you do is, for those that haven't occurred, the court instructs the jury that you can award future damages till you prove to a reasonable certainty. Now, I don't know that if we look at that case, if we tried this case today, he would have to prove for that, one, my client is liable in Iowa, two, liable due to a breach of duty of my client and Sean's, and three, here are the amount of damages that I owe. In other words, he'd be proving up the Iowa case in order to prove the case here. And I think that shows why it's not right. Is because on the duty to indemnify, we haven't established a duty. There may never be a judgment for which we're required to indemnify, ever. So it's a hypothetical.
If we agree with you on the rightness issue, what does that do with the statute of limitations?
I could not, and I will say this, if we win the rightness issue, I came back here and said the statute of limitations is barred. I got a feeling that I'd be out the door real quickly. I think it answers the question. If it's not right under indemnity, and the law of indemnity is it does not accrue until such time as you have the damages, I don't think the case is right for the statute of limitations either. It's the wrong word. I think it doesn't accrue. But I don't think that the statute of limitations can be a problem. And if I win, we're talking out of both sides of our mouth. And nobody's going to allow that. And frankly, I'm not going to do it. If that's okay, I'll yield to Mr. Minahan.
Thank you very much. Mr. Minahan, good morning to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sean Minahan on behalf of Unico Group and Sean Kruger. As I said before, our issues in this case are basically in lockstep with Midwest Exchange. So I'm going to try not to go over some of the details that Mr. Blagg discussed. And I wanted to maybe address some of those other questions that were presented to him. But the way we see this and the way
Before you dig too deeply into that, do you agree with what Mr. Blagg said about the statute of limitations?
I totally agree with it. And in fact, I think we argued it to the district court, is like we wouldn't be here today arguing a ripeness issue if we were going to be arguing a year down the road after the Iowa cases were complete that they're beyond the statute of limitations. And I wanted to talk about that specifically because the way we see this and the way we argued it was that the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction because the parties at the time of filing did not have a justiciable issue. Now, first one, I want to go back and talk about one of the things here is appellant seems to break this thing down into an indemnification claim and a duty to defend claim. I can't for the life of me figure out where they're getting this duty to defend claim from the insurance agent. There's a duty to defend contractually by the insurance companies. Neither one of these agents are captive agents nor compelled by the insurance contract itself.
Aren't they asking for the damages? They're not asking for the insurance agent to defend them. They're asking for the damages, the cost of defense in Iowa. But for the failure to have E&O policy, they would have defense coverage in Iowa. They're incurring damages as a result of that. So they're not asking, are they, for the agent? Or I would hope they don't want the agent to represent them in Iowa.
And that's exactly how we see it. And that's why we believe or argue that this is a pure indemnification claim, not a duty to defend claim. This duty to defend argument is really just an indemnification claim for damages that they incurred allegedly due to the negligence of my client, right?
But at least as to what they pay for defense costs, doesn't the indemnification claim mature or become ripe at that point? Aren't we really dealing with a case where part of it's ripe and part of it's not, potentially?
Potentially. But I would argue, and I think the easy discussion on this is that, as Mr. Blagg said, what would a trial court do? It would come in and would they try this thing on just the attorney fees that are incurred at the time of the filing or occurred at the time of when you hear that case? Or are they going to have a case regarding liability and then come back later and have a case regarding damages?
Is this where a stay might be useful?
A stay was actually submitted and suggested by the appellant. The point is if you already know your action isn't ripe to be heard.
Well, what if it's partially ripe and partially not? Is that where a stay might be useful? It's not, we can't kick it out because it's partially ripe, but we can stay it to allow it to ripen in its entirety.
So,
I'm just free associating. Could you bifurcate it?
Again, we're taking additional steps when all he had to do was wait until until his claim became ripe. And what it comes down to, we go back to the justiciable issue, right? If they have a justiciable issue, if they have two things, that case can be heard on that day, and a judicial decision could be made on that day based on the facts.
Can't that happen on the attorney's fees in Iowa right now if they're not seeking future attorney's fees? Couldn't they say, we're going to cap it at the $4,000 we've already paid, we want to try it on that issue and that issue alone? Couldn't they do that?
If they were willing to cap it on that issue, potentially. But I don't expect that they would be willing to cap it on that issue considering these cases are ongoing.
And so because they have potential future defense costs, that makes it not right?
That's exactly right.
Is there any authority, case law, or statutory authority for that proposition?
The statutory thing is in either City of Omaha and Stewart of Heinemann regarding justiciable issues again. Because not only do you have that situation, you also have the secondary part of that. Not only does he have to have a judicial determination at that point, but you have to have judicial enforceability at that point. So if they were going to cap their damages at only the attorney fees that they incurred up to the time of that hearing, potentially that issue is right. But they have commingled this entire thing of two different Iowa cases And I would subject this court to the fact that they have to prove that not only are they liable in that Iowa case, but they're liable for an action which would have been covered under the insurance policy.
For the identification.
For the indemnification.
But for the duty to defend, do they have to do that?
Again.
Do they have to prove that they were liable in Iowa for the defense cost to be?
Again, because there's no duty to defend by the agency, then there's no claim for duty to defend. It's an indemnification claim solely. And it's due to damages incurred for the failure to have insurance. A duty to defend, that's part and parcel to it, but there's no actual claim for a duty to defend.
Does this court have the power to send this back to the trial court and order the trial court to enter a stay?
I would assume that this court would have that power, but again, what you're doing here is they're asking for a decision to force the state of litigation pending the outcome of the Iowa cases, or force it to litigate the liability, which there may be none, and then have a second trial on the issue of damages. Again, which goes to our second part of any ripeness issue, is that they have to prove that the claims are fit for judicial decision, which they haven't done, and also have to prove that they suffer no hardship from withholding court consideration. I think we've dealt with the fact that they suffer no hardship from withholding the court consideration. That's a two-part test, and they have to meet both parts of that.
What hardship do you experience if there's a stay?
Well, we would have to continue to monitor the Iowa cases. We would have to continue to do, you know, updates on all of that stuff and potentially, you know, incur fees keeping our client up to date on those issues.
Well, even under your approach, aren't you going to have to do that?
Not necessarily, because we can, like I said, we can wait till the very end. But, Your Honors, I'm out of time. If there's no further questions.
Can I ask another question?
You may.
I'm having a hard time distinguishing between the specificity of damages in a personal injury action that you can delay and determine at the time of trial, and why the issue with regard to attorney fees would be any different. Because you get down to there, could you not have someone at trial opine, assuming qualification, opine as to what those attorney fee damages would be, even though they're not all incurred?
Right. I'd like to address that. I was thinking about that when that question was previously asked. Personal injury claims, when you have potential future medical expenses, you have a doctor come in who will testify that we believe that within so many years he's going to need another knee replacement, or he's going to need a knee replacement. This is the cost of that knee replacement. We know that. If he has future pain and suffering, they allow the jury to make a determination as to what that pain and suffering may be going on in the future up into their the mortality table, correct? In this case specifically, these damages are finite, right? They are based upon solely any potential liability or award of damages in the Iowa cases, which is going to be a specific number, and they're entitled to the specific number of attorney fees in which they will occur. So what are you going to have if you issue an order allowing appellate to go and try this case on the issue of future attorney fees when we know that attorney fees must be finite? If we allow that and the jury comes back and says, okay, or the attorney comes and says, I think this case may go to trial and may not go to trial. We're going to have a 4-day trial. We're going to have a 6-day trial on this one. We're going to have a 3-day trial on this one. It's going to take X amount of experts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? There's 1,000 different potential possibilities to determine attorney fees. If the jury is wrong about that, they get a windfall. If they go too high, right? But these damages, again, are finite. So do we get to go back and say, okay, here's what the actual attorney fees that they incurred in this case. Court, you need to give us a credit for that or a refund of that money. So in that regard, we do not believe that you can use a personal injury analogy in this case where the damages are specific. They just haven't occurred yet. And that's why it's not right.
Okay, may I ask one more?
Certainly.
I want to give one more shot at this. What prejudice would there be to your client from the granting of a stay.
Sure. I don't think the stay, well, two things. First of all, the economic prejudice is probably the same for a stay as it would be if this case isn't right. But the second part of that is the district court has to have subject matter jurisdiction in order to issue a stay. And if they don't have subject matter jurisdiction because the case is not right, they can't issue a motion to stay.
In the sense of this is a court of general jurisdiction, so it has jurisdiction over all types of cases.
Sure.
And has jurisdiction of the parties, right? So the ripeness doctrine, although I know we've said it's jurisdictional at times, is it really in this sense a matter of subject matter jurisdiction?
It is, because again, the ripeness doctrine is a consideration of whether or not the parties have a justiciable issue in which they can litigate. And based upon that, and based upon this court's prior precedent in determining the two-part test of whether or not a issue is justiciable or not, is clear in this case.
In the federal system, of course, where they are limited to case or controversy jurisdiction, I think perhaps you get a different answer. But here, whether or not the claim has validity, it's still the district court has jurisdiction over claims of this type.
I don't disagree.
I mean, we're talking about a common law claim, aren't we?
We are talking about a common law claim, but again, this court's precedent, City of Omaha versus City of Elkhorn and the Stewart versus Heineman case, set the two-part test for a justiciable issue. If it doesn't meet that two-part test, you don't have a justiciable issue, you don't have subject matter jurisdiction, and you can't order a stay without that subject matter jurisdiction.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 2 minutes and 55 seconds.
2 minutes and 55 seconds? 3 minutes. Mr. Weeks.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few things. Clarify, we are not seeking, the agencies to provide a defense. We are seeking damages related to the fact that we're paying our own defense, which would otherwise have been covered by an E&O policy. Go ahead.
How would you respond to Mr. Minahan's argument about prejudice?
I don't think there's any prejudice. I think if this case is remanded so that, it preserves the statute of limitations and there's a stay issued, then I'll let Mr. Minahan know when the Iowa cases are resolved. He doesn't even have to do that homework. I don't think that there's any prejudice. On the other hand, I would hate to be faced with a statute of limitations issue. So there could be some great harm there. Although,
did I hear you say when you were at the podium before that if we were to say that the case is not ripe, the statute of limitations problem, you don't really have one?
Not only that, Your Honor, but I think I heard the elements of promissory estoppel from opposing counsel and waiver. So. We may not have to worry about it just based on the record created here today. But I think if it is not ripe and I cannot bring the lawsuit, then I think I would be safe in any argument that could be raised on the statute of limitations.
Would your preference be to have a stay?
I would have preferred if the district court would have just stayed it. Go ahead.
What's your response to Mr. Minahan and Mr. Blagg's jurisdictional argument?
Well, the problem I have with the idea that the court did not have jurisdiction is I think clearly all four elements have been met. I think it's this bifurcation issue that we're dealing with, or there's this idea that it's ripe and not ripe. I mean, certainly, I think even
you're saying all four elements of a tort claim.
Yeah. We have damages. I mean, the fact that we don't have complete damages doesn't mean we don't have damages. We can meet all four elements. So to say that the court doesn't have jurisdiction, I think, is a real stretch,
Your position would be the $4,000 worth of attorney fees is sufficient damages to give the court jurisdiction, and that jurisdiction would allow the court to enter a stay to later figure out what the extent of those damages might be at some point in the future.
Correct. Just like you could do with a car accident case. And to torture that analogy a little bit further, you know, we have this concept of maximum medical improvement. Well, in this case, the Iowa cases have trial settings. That's our MMI in the Iowa cases, by analogy, is we are going to have a judgment, we are going to have a verdict, and we're going to know with pretty clear certainty as to approximately when that is going to occur. With that, if there's no other questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you all very much. This case is completed. You are excused, and the court is adjourned.